From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Greece was set to unveil temporary budget proposals Monday, as required by the country's creditors, as part of a four-month extension of its debt under an agreement reached late last week. We have this report from Press TV.
Officials in Greece say they're about to finalize a package of reforms that would take the national economy out of its current stalemate. A senior government official told media the measures aim to combat tax evasion and rampant corruption. The Eurozone ministers on Friday asked Athens to come up with a convincing reform proposal before Monday. Greece had earlier asked the European Union to grant it with a loan extension of up to 6 months. The Eurogroup says Greece must meet certain economic criteria before ministers agree to a four-month extension. Let's speak to Press TV's Konstantin Venizelos, who's standing by in Greece's capital, Athens, and he joins us via Skype. Now, Konstantin, what also catches the eye here is that other than aiming to combat tax evasion and rampant corruption, these measures will also be downsizing civil services. Isn't that just austerity?
Good morning, Kanis. Well, yes, Syriza's new reforms package will focus mainly on streamlining the civil service and battling corruption and tax evasion. Of course, these measures might not be enough to tomorrow convince European officials that there are sufficient reforms to sustain fiscal clarity according to Troika instructions. Therefore, you know, we are not yet certain if the Greek proposal presented tomorrow to European officials will suffice to have to finally approve this four-month extension of the bailout agreement. And of course, yes, it is a tremendous downsizing of the original anti-austerity is a portfolio which, as we have said before earlier in the week, has now, you know, has been minimized to convince European officials that Greece can sustain itself for another 4 months under Troikan supervision. And of course, the government is running the risk of finding itself in the same position it was 3 weeks ago in 4 months' time. Having said all of this, Kanis, I think it's worth to note here that internal reactions from within Syriza have already begun to emerge. European Euro Syriza MP Manolis Glezos, who is 92 years old and also a veteran of the Greek Second World War resistance, of course, his mental clarity is unparalleled, even though he's really old, has sent a letter to Greeks in which he apologizes, he says, for having participated in this, as he called it, anti-austerity illusion. And there are also other Syriza MPs who are beginning to voice their reaction against this political climb down by Tsipras. However, I think it's too early to judge the Syriza government. We have to wait and see how next week plays out and if these reforms will finally be accepted and Greece be granted this four-month extension.
A poll conducted during the negotiations between the Syriza-led government and its European partners revealed that 81% of the Greek population approves of the government's handling of negotiations. That poll was conducted from February 12th to February 17th, during which time the Greek government was negotiating, but before they had concluded and news emerged that the four-month bailout extension had been agreed upon by the parties. A total of three people were killed in Ukraine after a bomb was tossed out of a car at a rally in support of last year's coup. That rally took place in Kharkov, which is in the northeast part of the country, occupied by Kiev's forces. At least two people were killed in the explosion in the center of the city, and another died Monday. Authorities said four suspects in the case had been detained and weapons allegedly seized from them, which included a grenade launcher. And it may be happening about a week late, but according to Ukrainian military and Donbass local sources, it is happening, that being the withdrawal of heavy weapons as agreed upon in Minsk, which has begun and is expected to continue over the next 2 weeks. A mission from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe has entered the city of Debaltseve, the scene of bitter fighting last week, to monitor the process of heavy arms removal from the region. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe has more.
Under the truce mediated by Germany and France in Minsk, the withdrawal of the weapons was supposed to start last Tuesday. However, the ceasefire has been repeatedly violated since the deal was signed on February 15. In the meantime, Ukrainian forces and pro-Russian militias exchanged prisoners on Saturday to fulfill another phase of their agreements. Manuel Olsen-Reiter is editor-in-chief of Zerst, who joins us from Berlin to tell us what he thinks about this. Manuel Olsen-Reiter, at this point, a number of days have passed. Do you believe that Minsk II, as many are calling it, is going to stick?
Well, what I believe is that the Minsk II is a short of break and a short of very necessary break when we look how much the civilians at the front line and in eastern Ukraine suffered during the last months. We have to see that there was a real bloodshed among civilians, which are, by the way, all civilians, all Russians, what means they are on the very eastern part of Ukraine, while in western Ukraine, where Kiev is governing, we don't have any civilian victims. So for these people, it is an encouraging sign, but it will not end the conflict. It is an agreement about a break in the war, and it's not a peace agreement. We shouldn't forget this, because the conflict itself is still not solved, and it shows that also, like Minsk I agreement, and what also now happens since Minsk II, is that the truce is violated always, especially, by the way, by the Kiev side, which was always trying to get some more territories back. So we should wait, and we should simply be happy right now for the civilians in the area that they get a break, and that they get a break to breath and to recover.
Isn't it very telling that when you think about this war, which at this point is going through what you're terming as a recession in a way, is really not about Ukraine's governments and Russia or the eastern side. It's been more involved about the players outside of this country, namely the United States and Russia, or the European Union and Russia. What does that say about this conflict overall?
Exactly. It is the Western narrative, what we have in Western mainstream media. They report about this war that it is about the form of governance in Ukraine. What we had, by the way, since more than a year, since the Maidan riots, that they were saying it is about how Ukraine is governed, if there is democracy, if there is a sort of Western liberty and so on. But all this is wrong. It's a geopolitical conflict. We speak about geopolitical spheres of influence. And the Ukrainian, in our days, the Ukrainian government, the government of Poroshenko, is a Western proxy sitting in Kiev. We know that he gets support by the European Union as well as from the United States of America, and he has a clear mission to gain the power in this very important geopolitical spot right in front of the gates to Russia, to say it like this. And we have on the other side, of course, Russia, and the Russians in Ukraine, which are feeling to be part of the Russian world and also to feel that they want to be part of Russia. At least they don't want to be part of the West and of the European Union. So all this conflict has a much bigger meaning than just forms of governance, democracy, corruption, and so on. And we can compare this conflict with the conflicts we had in the Caucasian area, with the Georgian war, but also with the Chechenian wars, where we had always those two players on the battlefield, on the back of the militants on the back battlefield. We have always the West supporting supporting militants or in the Georgian conflict, the Georgian army. It is about geopolitical influence, and it is about the plan of the West or the idea of the West to have a unipolar world order, what means to have the influence everywhere in the world. And it's about the defense of those parts in the world. There is not one central other pole defending. We have many other little poles who are defending themselves against this Western influence. We can count for this, for example, also the Islamic Republic of Iran. We can count Russia. We can count China. Also Syria is defending itself right now against becoming part sort of spiritual or mental colony or even an economical colony of the Western world. So this is what we see now in Ukraine, and this is what this war is about. And as long this problem is not solved, there will be not an eternal peace. It will go on. We will have now a truce agreement, but the problem is not solved at all.
Meanwhile, former Ukrainian Prime Minister Nikolai Azarov said he was ready to gather opposition forces for the formation of what he called a government in exile to represent the interests of former government and opposition figures forced to abandon the country in the wake of the coup of a year ago by ultranationalist groups. The former prime minister said he was, quote, ready to meet with professionally competent people with the knowledge and experience to create a group, closed quote, capable of confronting the coup government, which he termed the anti-Ukrainian regime. Azarov, who was prime minister from 2010 to 2014, made his remarks on the Russian TV program The Right to Know on the first anniversary of events in Kiev, which led to the overthrow of President Viktor Yanukovych. He insisted on the need to create a representative body to offer the Ukrainian people a viable alternative viewpoint to that of the Kiev government and to formulate a plan of development for the country. After over half a century of exemplary peaceful policies, Japan is apparently ready to take another step towards the nullification of its post-war constitutional ban on war-making. The country's conservative government, under Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, has been steadily moving away from the restrictions of Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, which reads, quote, the Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat or use of force as means of settling international disputes. Land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained. The right of belligerency of the state will not be recognized, closed quote. Those provisions were reinterpreted to allow for a so-called self-defense force in 1954. However, the so-called self-defense force is one of the best-equipped militaries in the world. And in July 2014, Abe's government issued another reinterpretation, which extended the right of its self-defense forces to defend allies in joint defense arrangements. This so-called reinterpretation would enable Japan to come to the aid of the U.S. or other allies, even if Japan is not the target of an attack. Under the previous reinterpretation, Japan's military could only act if the country was under direct threat. Last month, the Japanese government approved the country's largest military budget in 70 years in a display of force to its neighbors. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's cabinet gave the green light to an unprecedented nearly 5 trillion yen or $42 billion defense budget, which comes into effect this April. As bad as they actually were, the past 7 decades would have been even bloodier without the existence of the United Nations. That's what UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told delegates during a Security Council discussion on Monday. On the agenda set by China was a discussion focused on impediments to peace in the world today, with a hoped-for reaffirmation of the world's commitment to the UN Charter, which was signed in San Francisco 70 years ago in 1945. Stephanie Castro reports from the United Nations.
2015 marks 70 years since the creation of the UN. The anniversary finds an organization with major achievements to its credit, Ban Ki-moon underscored, but also multiple crises on its agenda.
The United Nations was founded to prevent another world war, and it has succeeded in that. Despite the recurrence of genocide and repeated outbreaks of armed conflicts, the past 7 decades would surely have been even bloodier without the United Nations.
Terrorism and extremism have emerged as serious transnational threats, the Secretary General also warned. Meanwhile, domestic challenges like public health, environmental degradation, and climate change are becoming more global in nature. The UN must be willing to act before situations deteriorate and can't afford to be indifferent, he urged. Stephanie Castro, United Nations.
Workers at 3 U.S. oil refineries, one of them the largest in the country, and a chemical processing plant, joined a mass nationwide strike affecting some 20% of U.S. petroleum refining capacity. Previously, 11 facilities and 5,200 workers were out on strike, led by the United Steelworkers Union. That strike entered its fourth week Sunday after the union failed to reach an agreement with Royal Dutch Shell. The Steelworkers Union represents more than 30,000 American oil workers at more than 200 refineries. The mass walkout of refinery workers is the first since 1980. Some 1,350 additional USW members are employed at the 3 refineries and chemical plant, which together have a daily capacity of 1 million barrels per day. USW Vice President Tom Conway, in a statement at the union's website, usw.org, said, quote, we're committed to reaching a settlement that works for both parties, but adequate staffing levels, worker fatigue, and other important safety issues must be addressed, close quote. Gary Beavers, the union's international vice president who oversees its oil sector, appeared ready to expand the walkout well beyond the striking plants. He was quoted at the steelworkers' website as saying, quote, if it takes a global fight to win safe workplaces, so be it, closed quote. Among other safety issues, the union points to management failures, which, according to the Federal Chemical Safety Board, led to an explosive fire at a Chevron refinery in Richmond, California, in August of 2012. That fire, according to the federal CSB, produced a toxic cloud, which caused more than 15,000 people to seek medical treatment at nearby hospitals for breathing problems and other symptoms. The following narrative, produced for the federal CSB, provides some of the details about that incident.
The Chevron Richmond Refinery lies approximately 10 miles northeast of San Francisco in California's Contra Costa County. The 2,900-acre facility was initially established in 1902 and primarily makes transportation fuels such as gasoline and diesel, as well as lube oils. The refinery can process up to 250,000 barrels of crude oil per day. The first step of the refining process takes place in the crude unit, where crude oil is cleaned and heated before entering the distillation tower. Inside the tower, the crude oil is boiled. The vapor then condenses into various liquid hydrocarbon fractions, or streams, including jet fuel, diesel, and gas oil. The different streams exit the distillation tower through separate pipes or side cuts that lead to other sections of the refinery. On August 6, 2012, the crude unit was operating normally. Around 3:50 that afternoon, an operator was performing a routine check when he noticed a small puddle on the ground near the distillation tower. The liquid appeared to be dripping from an 8-inch insulated pipe 14 feet overhead. The leaking pipe was a section of the tower's number 4 side cut line, which operated at a temperature of 640 degrees Fahrenheit and contained light gas oil, a combustible liquid similar to diesel fuel. Chevron inspectors knew that over the years, the walls of the number 4 side cut had thinned due to corrosion, but they did not realize how close this particular segment was to failure. There was no shutoff valve between the pipe and the distillation tower, and no way to isolate the leak. The head operator was called to the scene. Although he believed the situation was serious, he did not believe the small leak warranted immediately shutting down the unit and stopping production. Following Chevron's standard practice for responding to hazardous leaks, refinery firefighters were sent to the scene. A number of managers, engineers, and technicians gathered there informally to assess the problem. The group discussed a recommendation from an operator to shut down the unit. But they decided to first try to pinpoint the leak by removing insulation from the pipe while the crude unit was still running. They hoped they could stop the leak with a temporary metal fitting known as a clamp. A Chevron firefighter tried using a pike pole to hook and pull away the insulation. But this poking action was deemed too dangerous because it was moving the pipe. The CSB later found that the tip of the pike likely caused a small puncture in the already thinned pipe. As the unit continued to operate, workers assembled scaffolding directly beneath the leaking pipe. Two firefighters then used a hook to remove the insulation from the pipe. As they were working, hydrocarbon vapor began to flow out from underneath the insulation. The two firefighters backed away from the growing vapor cloud. As the hot vapor mixed with air, it ignited. That fire was quickly put out, and the two firefighters immediately climbed down off the scaffolding. But the exact location of the leak was still obscured by the remaining insulation and firefighting water. So the Chevron firefighters attempted to strip the insulation off the pipe with high-pressure water. But the leak suddenly worsened, and hot hydrocarbon liquid started to spray out of the pipe. A decision was finally made to begin an emergency shutdown of the crude unit. But it was too late. Suddenly, the pipe ripped open. A vapor cloud formed and rapidly expanded as the large inventory of hydrocarbons in the distillation tower started to vent through the ruptured pipe. The vapor cloud immediately spread over hundreds of feet, engulfing all 19 people who had gathered nearby. The firefighters and operators struggled to escape through the dense hydrocarbon cloud, unable to see. They had to feel their way out, some on their hands and knees. At approximately 6:30 p.m., 2 minutes after the huge vapor cloud formed, the hydrocarbons ignited. One firefighter was trapped inside a fire engine when it was suddenly engulfed in flames. He radioed for help.
Mayday, mayday, mayday! This is foam 60!
But when he received no response, he assumed everyone else was dead. To escape the inferno, he fled through what witnesses described as a wall of fire. Fortunately, all the workers would eventually flee to safety, and there were no fatalities. The towering white vapor cloud could be seen as far away as San Francisco on the unusually clear August day. After the ignition, a dense plume of black smoke formed and drifted away from the refinery. The fire continued burning for hours. Over the succeeding days, more than 15,000 people sought medical treatment at nearby hospitals for breathing problems and other symptoms. During its investigation, the CSB determined that the carbon steel pipe installed in 1976 had thinned to the point of failure from an effect known as sulfidation corrosion. Carbon steel piping is particularly susceptible to this type of corrosion, which occurs over time when the steel is exposed to sulfur-containing hydrocarbons at high temperatures. Steel piping that happens to be low in the element silicon corrodes especially quickly. The CSB learned that sulfidation corrosion had caused a major failure at Chevron's refinery in Salt Lake City, Utah, in 2002. Chevron then performed an enhanced inspection of the No. 4 side cut pipe at the Richmond refinery. It revealed accelerated thinning in the piping section that would ultimately fail in 2012. Replacement was recommended, but this did not occur, and the section of piping was never inspected again. In 2009, Chevron experts recommended that every segment of high-risk carbon steel piping be inspected for corrosion. However, this was not done. During a maintenance turnaround of the crude unit in 2011, Chevron inspectors examined some, but not all, locations along the No. 4 side cut and found significant thinning. Some sections were replaced, but managers decided that the line was thick enough to stay in service and that an overall replacement could wait up to 5 more years. According to CSB investigators, a key lesson is that each and every segment of the piping should have been inspected. Most importantly, the pipe should have been replaced much earlier with an inherently safer corrosion-resistant alloy. The CSB also concluded that had the crude unit been shut down when the leak was first noticed, the massive fire likely would not have occurred. The 19 workers would never have been endangered, and the community would have been protected.
The United Steelworkers Union represents 850,000 workers in North America, employed in industries that include metals, rubber, chemicals, paper, oil refining, and service and public sectors. The union's workforce accounts for 64% of all U.S. fuel output. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry expressed concern about the viability of the Palestinian Authority as Israel refuses to unfreeze Palestinian tax money.
If the Palestinian Authority ceases or were to cease security cooperation or even decide to disband as a result of their economic predicament, and that could happen in the near future if they don't receive additional revenues, then we would be faced with yet another crisis that could also greatly impact the security of both Palestinians and Israelis. And that would have the potential of serious ripple effects elsewhere in the region.
Israel blocked more than $100 million in January in response to the authorities' move to join the International Criminal Court. Being a member of the tribunal enables the Palestinians to take legal action against Israeli crimes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, The U.S. has already said that Israel's retaliatory move could further escalate tensions. The funds are vital for running the Palestinian Authority and for paying civil servants' salaries. Israel's top legal advisor says he's not concerned about the possibility of a probe by the International Criminal Court into the war last summer that killed thousands of men, women, and children in Gaza, most of them civilians. We'll have more on that tomorrow.
In 1995, I was wrongfully arrested, and in 1997, I was convicted of a first-degree murder that I had nothing to do with.
On June 14, 2012, Lorenzo Johnson, whose wrongful conviction was finally overturned by a federal appeals court, turned himself in to go back to prison, again serving out his sentence of life without parole for a murder in 1995 that he insists he did not commit. Johnson's claim of innocence had sanction from the appeals court. After serving more than 15 years of his sentence, with a trail of paper and proceedings through both the federal and state court systems, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit decided that the state had failed to prove his guilt and ordered him released. After his release, his case went before the U.S. Supreme Court, which ordered him back to prison the following year. We'll be covering this case in depth over the next few weeks as we discuss the details with Lorenzo Johnson from the Frackville, Pennsylvania prison where he's currently held. We spoke with him this past Sunday to get some of the basics.
I was in the state when it took place, and it took place in Pennsylvania, and I was in New York. And they had used a witness that was a crack abuser, you know, to put me on the scene because I have a co-defendant, you know, and I was labeled as an accomplice. And to make a long story short, I went through a whole bunch of the appeal process, and a lot of my witnesses was threatened by the police, and a lot of evidence was never turned over to my defense. So in 2011, the highest federal court in Pennsylvania, Third Circuit Court of Appeals, issued my appeal, granted my appeal, and I won on the grounds of insufficient evidence.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
And I won on the grounds of insufficient evidence, which is equivalent to a not guilty verdict. So they had to discharge me. So my life sentence was vacated. I went back to New York. You know, I started working. I started speaking at colleges and the community centers and stuff like that about wrongful convictions. And all the while, the prosecution had one appeal left to the United States Supreme Court in Washington. So while this was taking place on May 29th, 2012, the United States Supreme Court came back with a decision reinstating my conviction on a technicality. So what happened was, you know, I had to turn myself back in on June 14th, 2012. I came back in, and me and my legal team, we started, you know, top to bottom, once again, investigation, you know, on my innocence and in the whole case as a whole. And we came up for 18 years that, you know, the police department and the district attorney office, well, the attorney general, because that's who prosecutes this case, they were withholding evidence that would show corruption in my innocence all this time, and we never knew about this.
Wow.
So, you know, we've got an appeal pending now as of August 13th, 2013, that's pending in front of my trial judge with all type of new evidence, even evidence that clears me. So, you know, we're waiting for, we got a file next week, and then after next week, we'll be waiting for a decision for a hearing.
Let me ask you a question. In the original conviction, was the fact that they convicted you, despite the fact that you were out of the state, because of malice or just incompetence and negligence? In other words, did they have it out for you, or were you just handy and they needed somebody?
Yeah. It was a little of both. They needed somebody. It was a malicious prosecution from day one. Like, you know, even right now, they're fighting me tooth and nail. You know, it took them 2 years to file a reply to our appeal I just told you about. And on Christmas Eve, 2014, they just filed their, their reply. And then they reply.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
And their reply, they said that, you know, I have unleashed the defamatory dogs from hell on them. And in reality, it's like, you know, if you don't, who's going to have you do your job? You understand what I'm saying?
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.